Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode is all about apprenticeships. We've all come to the agreement in our society that it turns out not only is college not for everyone, but sending everyone there in the first place isn't quite the right solution to making sure people are prepped to pursue their own version of the American dream. So if everyone agrees about this fact, why is it that we still do not have the apprenticeship infrastructure and option for enough people in this country? With that big question in mind, I'm speaking with the author Ryan Craig. He has a new book out. It's called Apprentice Nation, and it gets to all these difficulties because I'm always obsessed with policy areas or political categories where everyone agrees, but nothing seems to be happening. There's usually a reason for that, and of course, in this conversation, Ryan and I get right into that. Hope you all enjoy, and seriously, if you're interested in apprenticeships or you're a person who works in the higher ed or K-12 space and want to get your students ready for that option, this is a perfect book and a great conversation. Hope you all enjoy it and have a great weekend. Ryan Craig, welcome to The Realignment.
Marshall, great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you. Your book legitimately answers so many questions I've had in the back of my mind for a long time being interested in this topic. Let's just start here. I've dealt with a lot of controversial topics on this podcast before. However, apprenticeships should not be and are not in that controversial category. Everyone from your most center-left DC person to your most right-wing populist in Ohio will say we need more apprenticeships. Given that that's true, the next most obvious question is, okay, then why aren't we doing this if it's become conventional wisdom? I'd love to kind of hear your response as an expert in this field to my just intuiting this reality as a person who surveys the narrative.
Yeah, look, that's a very informed thing to say. I would give you one caveat, which is that not all college faculty would agree with that statement. I'm in the midst of just the book came out a couple of days ago, and I'm traveling around and giving a bunch of talks, including some on college campuses and some to higher education audiences. And not everyone agrees with that, but I would say most people, the vast majority of people would agree. It does seem to have purchase across the political spectrum, at least. And so everyone's in favor of it. Why aren't we doing it more? And I think the reason is first of all, is that college is still seen as the primary and still only socially acceptable pathway to economic opportunity, because I think in part it really echoes the American dream, which is that you should be able to do anything you want and discover your capabilities and passions and lift yourself up by your bootstraps and so forth. And that was all well and good when college cost, even $5,000 or $10,000 a year. But today, colleges, cost anywhere from $20,000 to $75,000 a year, plus room and board. And students are graduating with six figures of student loan debt and graduating into an economy that has changed. People talk about apprenticeship and everyone thinks that the responsibility for creating them should be on someone else. So most people would say, well, companies need to create apprenticeships and hire apprentices. And companies will say, well, we're not in the business of doing that. We're in the business of, producing and delivering a product or service. And, we're not in the, business of setting up and running apprenticeship programs. And kind of as you know from the book, the dirty little secret is that there are places around the world where apprenticeships thrive. And in fact, they thrive more in every other developed country than they thrive here. We are last among developed countries on apprenticeship, but wherever they do thrive, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, in the construction trades here in the US, it's not because employers are more benevolent there, more farsighted, and they set them up and run them on their own. No, apprenticeships thrive because there are intermediaries who either are required by law or who are incentivized to set up and run these programs for employers. So in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, those are large chambers of commerce and unions who do that heavy lifting of setting, and we'll get into, I think, what, you know, what it means to set up and run an apprenticeship program, but take my word for it for now, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work that your typical company or employer doesn't do, isn't used to doing. And in the construction trades here in the US, it's unions who do that work. What's interesting is that a generation ago, the UK and Australia looked a lot like the US in terms of having small apprenticeship sectors, very small, almost all in construction. And today those countries are doing 8 times better than we are in terms of apprentices as a percentage of the workforce. We're at 0.3%. They're at something like 2.4% of the workforce. So there are 8 times as many apprentices per capita in those countries. What did they do? Well, they recognized that central truth, that employers don't create them, intermediaries create them. And so they incentivized the establishment of a robust ecosystem of intermediaries who do that work, do that heavy lifting, knock on doors, offer to set up and run these programs and do it. And so it makes it, in many cases, turnkey to employers to have it. It's easy when you have a half a dozen apprenticeship intermediaries, apprenticeship service providers knocking on your door, offering to set up and run apprenticeship programs at virtually no cost or hassle to you. That's very different from where we are in the US today.
I love that answer to the question because I want listeners to think about this issue structurally. And to your point, I set this up by saying everyone agrees internships are good, but your key takeaway seems to be here. You could agree to that being a good thing, but A, like, this has to make sense for the employer. It has to make sense for the actual student. So understanding how those bits fit together is key here. Something you wrote in the book.
So apprenticeships are jobs. So they're not, that's the important thing to recognize. So they're jobs first and foremost, and they start with an employer willing to do the very unnatural task of hiring and paying for someone who by definition is not going to be productive for an extended period of time. So that's why apprenticeships are hard, because for most employers, that's anathema, right? Why would I hire and pay someone who's not going to be productive for 3, 6, 9, 12 months? Why? And 99.9% of employers won't do that. So employers need help. They need convincing. They're not going to do it on their own.
So I guess the way to think about this is you start off the book by offering this quote of, you know, we used to be a nation of apprentices. So many of our founding fathers, in fact, were literally apprentices. But when you're talking about this intermediary problem, and you're talking about in the modern era, we spend so much more money at the state and federal level on higher education than we spend on apprenticeship programs. Obviously, in the late 1700s, we didn't really have a government that was spending money on either ends of that spectrum. So that's right. What changed over the course of American history to make it necessary for employers to start doing that very unnatural thing? Or is the nature of what an apprenticeship is just changed a lot over that period too?
Yeah, look, I think the nature of work has changed a lot too, right? Those jobs that those, you know, our founding fathers did, they were easily apprenticeable because those trades, you could kind of do what I call follow Joe around, right? You hold the tools, right? So you could be kind of useful from day one. Today with digital jobs, that's not obvious, right? You can't be useful on day one as a Salesforce administrator if you've never used Salesforce before. So, I think the nature of work has changed to make it harder. But what's also made it harder is that, we had a education revolution in this country and determined that the work requires a higher level of education, and everyone and the pathway to those jobs lies through 4 years of college. And that worked fine when college was more affordable and employers were willing to hire into good jobs new and recent graduates who didn't have any specific discernible skills or experience. So that worked pretty well for the, you know, what I'll call the good jobs of the 20th century. I think about working at, you know, in Don Draper's office, the advertising agency in Mad Men, right? What kind of skills did someone need to work as an account executive in that agency? Probably not too many. You probably went to the right school. You knew how to behave at a, you know, three martini lunch with Don Draper, but you didn't have any very specific skills. Today, you know, the good jobs that college grads are trying to get are demanding a specific combination of digital platform skills, business knowledge, and increasingly experience. So we have a skills gap because colleges aren't teaching those skills. And increasingly, we have an experience gap, which is a huge problem. So cybersecurity is a great example of that. A decade ago, candidates, you know, new graduates with a modicum of technical experience could get an entry-level job in a, you know, managed security service provider, a cybersecurity firm. And you'd be kind of the first rung of defense. You'd look at the alerts, decide which to elevate, which to resolve, and so forth. And you'd be able to do that. Today, you know, all of that has been automated. And now the entry-level cybersecurity job is a higher-level job that you really can't do without experience. In fact, if you look at job descriptions for entry-level in cybersecurity, they're asking for CISSP certifications, which require 3 years experience. So, and that's what, automation and generative AI are going to do to entry-level work in this country. Think about your first good job. My first good job, I was a consultant and I spent most of my time developing presentations that no one was, you know, ever going to look at or do anything about. And today, all of that work is going to be done by AI. So, if I were applying for that job today, my employer would expect me to be able to do higher value work, spend my time on higher value work that I would need experience to do. There's just no question that to do more than that, you know, the menial work, the grunt work that I did 25 years ago to kind of learn the ropes of the business, today that's not going to, you know, I'm not going to have time for that. AI is going to do that. I'm going to be expected to do higher value work, which I won't be able to do without experience. So that experience gap is going to grow more and more profound. And so the question we need to ask ourselves as a country is, you know, unless we're going to somehow stop digital transformation and AI, how are we going to ensure that young people can still launch careers if there's going to be a growing experience gap? And the answer has to be, we need to figure out a way to integrate experience, real work experience, relevant work experience into the educational pathway. So apprenticeship is the best way I know to do that, because apprenticeships by definition are jobs where you're not hired based on your skills or experience. You're hired, you don't have the skills and experience. You're hired into an apprenticeship so you can gain those skills and experience. And there's a willing employer willing to pay you and give you those skills and experience. So it is the natural solution. It's not the only solution. It's the best solution. There are other solutions like internships, like work integrated learning. But the best solution is apprenticeship. And so if that's going to happen, you know, we need them today. We're going to need them more in 10 years than we need them today. And we need to go and begin building that apprenticeship infrastructure, because we've spent decades and trillions of dollars investing in the world's leading college infrastructure. We have the best, you know, higher education infrastructure in the world. We've invested the most money in it. We have, among developed countries, the world's worst earn and learn infrastructure. We don't have an apprenticeship infrastructure in this country outside of the construction trades. And one reason is we just haven't invested the money. For every, you know, a dollar that we invest in earn and learn, we're investing over $1,000 in college. If you compare the amount of taxpayer support that a apprentice receives relative to a college student, for every dollar that apprentice receives of public money, the college student's getting $50. So I don't know if the right ratio is 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 or 10-to-1, but it sure ain't 50-to-1 or 1,000-to-1. Mm-hmm. We are way out of bounds by an order of magnitude from other developed countries, which have invested more in earn and learn pathways. And with the way the economy is going with digital transformation, earn and learn pathways may be the only way young people are going to launch careers and achieve economic mobility.
You know, what I love about your framing of that entry-level job, once again, going back to the structural, is you kind of reframed the unhelpful way we talk about, is AI going to take, you know, my job? as a podcaster, think tank fellow, academic, because if we look at my career broadly, no, I'm very, very confident in my abilities. But my first job was as a researcher at PBS in New York City, where all I actually did was, okay, we have Chris Christie coming on next week. Marshall, take the afternoon and write 20 questions you'd want to ask Chris Christie. That's the definition of something that AI could already do right now, frankly, quicker and better than I can, just in terms of the actual, that's accomplished in 2 seconds. And then also, my other job was fact-checking, which will also be there eventually too. So it's not just saying, hey, Marshall, are you as a creator going to be fine? It's no, there's going to be this very specific period at the start of your career where you weren't being paid that much, but that's where the Cambrian explosion of your actual career came from. And that getting cut off is really key here. So something I want to make very clear here, because you've kind of hinted at this and folks may miss this, you're not quite making the micro dirty jobs critique, which I think people frequently confuse into the apprenticeship debate.
Yes, that's part of the problem, in fact.
Differentiate these two things.
People confuse apprenticeships with, or conflate them with plumbers and welders and so forth. And those are good jobs and great careers and so forth. And we need more people doing those jobs. And we need more apprentices in those jobs to meet the demand for those jobs. But my point is that that's not where the growth in jobs are. In the economy, that's a small part of it. The bigger job, the by far the lion's share of the growth is in digital jobs, good tech jobs across healthcare, tech, finance, financial services, logistics, and you name it. The fact of the matter is we've digitized our economy, and processes that were manual are now digital, and good jobs require being facile with digital platforms. They could be horizontal platforms, they could be functional platforms, they can be vertical platforms, but the work of America is done digitally now, and you need to be able to do that. So and you have the skills gap. Colleges are not training on these skills, and you have this growing experience gap as well. So how are people going to access these good jobs? And the answer is, the oldest way before college, apprenticeship. But we need to rethink what apprenticeship is, right? We haven't been funding it enough. We've been conflating it with workforce training, right? Mm-hmm. The way we fund it, it's all funded through workforce training programs. Apprenticeships are not workforce development, not workforce training. They're jobs. They're jobs first, where the hard part is.
Could you explain, that may be unclear to people, what is the difference between workforce development and a job?
So a workforce development program would be a program like Job Corps, where you provide a 15 to 30 week vocational training program to a unemployed or underemployed worker or youth, right? And at the end of it, you kind of, I call it train and pray, kind of pray that they're going to take advantage of that course and the skills, and they'll be more employable at the end. And that characterizes the billions of dollars that we spend in workforce development with really no measurable outcomes in employment and no accountability for that money. So we're also, out of that same money, funding apprenticeships, which is one reason why we're not funding it enough, because it's just a fraction of money that's kind of poorly spent. But apprenticeships are not poorly spent. We know that the return on investment on for apprentices, obviously for themselves, the apprentices themselves, is infinite, because they're not investing tuition. They're being paid from day one. It's a full-time job. There's, employment is resolved from the beginning. You're employed. And a great return on investment for the companies that end up employing these apprentices, and a great return on investment for the government that invests or subsidizes apprenticeships. So we should do more of it. But it's sort of lumped in because there's a training element to apprenticeships, right? You have a on-the-job training portion, you have a classroom-based training portion. And so it's conflated with all these other workforce training programs, and it's different. It's different because they're jobs. And because they're jobs, the first and really only important question is, which employer is going to take a chance on hiring and paying for a worker who's going to be unproductive for a period of time? And again, You know, nowhere is our employers doing it themselves at scale on their own dime. It happens because we have intermediaries to do the heavy lifting, and because governments subsidize and fund the cost of apprenticeship. We're not doing that here. We can. The fix is not going to be huge. And the good news is, as you said at the outset, these changes are going to have bipartisan support.
You say something interesting in the book, which I think would be easy to miss. You point out that in the past, the terms college, teachers' college, technical college, these different models of higher education, while we use them interchangeably today, they actually meant quite different things.
That's right.
So I'm curious, if we're looking at a broad college system that's under a lot of stressors that you go into the book, declining enrollment, poor performances in terms of graduating within 6 years, a deep amount of partisanship from both sides of the aisle for saying that apprenticeships are very uncontroversial, higher education, especially given its state funding, is at the complete other end of it. I'm wondering, what structural or conceptual changes could we make to the higher ed system that would make it make sense within this world? Because there's a world where, hey, maybe a 2-year technical degree is supplemented with an apprenticeship program. This isn't purely, do you go to college or do you take an apprenticeship? Yeah. What's your advice there?
Yeah, look, I think the key is innovation. And the fact is that we have a highly monolithic higher education system where the leaders of these institutions know what excellent is. Many of them have attended highly selective, excellent institutions. And they all kind of want to be the Harvard of X. And even, you know, you'd be surprised, some community colleges, regional publics, they take that approach. And so we've sort of had this winnowing of a variety of institutions. They're not nearly as diverse as they once were. I've been in higher education for over 25 years. I believe I have the experience to be able to say that higher education is very hard to change, and the best way to change it is when institutions are facing an enrollment or financial gap. So I think that the way in which higher education institutions get into the business of earn and learn, in addition to just taking tuition and telling students to take on debt, is when students vote with their feet and opt for these new earn and learn pathways that are being created, and I expect increasingly funded by the federal and state governments. So we have an infrastructure problem. We have great tuition-based, debt-based infrastructure. We have very, very poor earn and learn infrastructure. Once we fund that, you're gonna see schools begin to shift and move, and I expect you're going to see colleges and community colleges become apprenticeship service providers. They will, shift their model. They will get into the business of not just delivering the training component of apprenticeships, but actually serving as kind of the general contractor and prime mover on these things, and actually setting up organizations that will knock on employers' doors and offer to set up and run these programs for them. Not everyone is going to do that, but we're going to see some, and they're going to be very successful. And they're going to be the ones who sort of make this transition to more of a balanced sort of tuition-based earn and learn career launch system.
Something I'm curious about, and once again, you hint at this in the book, the greatest legacy player advantage the higher ed system has is just anyone's, as an audience, think back to when you were 12 and you're watching like a movie and you see characters on a college campus. It's beautiful. It's compelling. And obviously you could see all sorts of statistics that don't quite work at the long term, but I think you're always going to have that image. I think by retreating into the dirty jobs narrative, or the like we're bringing shop class back narrative, there is just no way that at a cultural imagination level is going to compete. You do, however, bring up the statistic that amongst younger generations, I'm a middle-aged millennial, so right below me, the image of being like a YouTuber or a content creator, really having your own destiny in your own hands is a deeply felt and compelling one. We see this in all of the polling. I'm wondering if there's a way that that narrative could be fashioned into one that supports the apprenticeship, the earning to learn. I'm curious, because I'm just trying to think of like different cultural models that would work. There.
That's interesting. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, I think that part of the problem is that there's virtually no career discovery before the end of high school, right? You don't have it in middle school. You don't have it in high school. It's all about college, college preparation, track for college, honors courses, AP courses, and so forth. Like, to the extent that limiting discovery at the high school level, because, you know, you take music courses and you take other courses where there's no honors and AP track, and you're, you know, getting a GPA on a 4 basis as opposed to a 5 weighted. So you're, you know, penalizing your chances of getting into a good college by doing that. So discovery is really, you know, this college for all approach, and the fact that we don't have a great diversity of types of college has really led to this narrowing. And this lack of discovery. So I think that, again, in terms of sequencing this, the key is earn and learn infrastructure. We need hundreds and then thousands of apprenticeship programs that are hiring, you know, not just 25-year-olds, but hopefully 18 and 19-year-olds across all of these sectors of the economy. And once we have that, then you're going to have career discovery in high school. And that sort of, you know, once you have that, then you can imagine young people beginning to imagine futures for themselves that might be different from that, you know, vision of, you know, the bucolic, you know, quad, you know, throwing a Frisbee around, walking, you know, barefoot with a friend. There are different visions. There are different pathways to launch. And in fact, you know, that place exists, and it's called the UK, which this fall, for the first time, the common app of the UK was called UCAS, the way you apply to university in the UK. This fall, for the first time, UCAS, alongside all the universities and university programs, is listing all the apprenticeship programs as well in the UK, thousands of apprenticeship programs. So in the UK, you graduating, you know, from high school this year, you will be able to sit with your guidance counselor and say, well, do I want a tuition-based option? Do I want an earn and learn option? In my mind, for many young people, an earn and learn pathway, an opportunity to support themselves in a good job with built-in wage progression, with built-in career pathways, with benefits, not, you know, working, you know, kind of frontline retail or, you know, the kind of jobs that are available today to high school graduates, but a true apprenticeship, that would be a better bet than simply kind of blindly choosing a college and taking on tens of thousands of dollars of student loan debt, right? I mean, if, you know, think about this sort of, I'm going around the country talking at a bunch of colleges, and I always get the question, well, what about career, what about discovery? You know, the fact that, you know, you go to college and you after 2 years of taking, you know, a suite of courses, you have you recognize here's what I really want to do. I fall in love with a, you know, topic and find my life's purpose. And I say, well, okay, that's your kind of best case scenario. Your base case scenario right now is someone who either doesn't complete, enrolls but doesn't complete, or completes and graduates into underemployment. It's about 70% of those who've enrolled in a 4-year school, and I'm not talking about the elite schools, I'm talking about all, the average, the median school, 70% of those who've enrolled in the past 10 years either have failed to complete or have graduated and not gotten a good job. So that's your base case. The apprentice, the worst case, but let's say somebody decides out of high school, they're going to take a job as a apprentice data analyst. Okay, they're going to do a 2-year data analyst apprenticeship program. And after 2 years of working full time, they decide they don't like data and they hate analysis. Total waste of time. who's worse off? The college base case or my worst case apprentice? My worst case apprentice has worked for 2 years, supported themselves, learned, you know, something about their interests and capabilities, and is more likely now to make a much more informed decision as to whether to go to college, what college program or institution to pursue than, you know, they were 2 years ago. Compare that to the base case college student who's either, you know, dropped out with debt or is underemployed with debt. And I think you'll agree that, you know, having as an option hundreds or thousands of apprenticeship programs across the economy would be a very positive thing for career launch without regard to the digital transformation and AI issue we talked about at the outset. So that's just today. It's going to get much worse. It's going to get much harder for that college grad to get a good job. So that base case is going to get worse over the next decade.
You know, the thing that's legitimately inspiring reading your book and hearing you discuss here is the opportunity we have to reimagine the way we're thinking about this. So I was thinking of, okay, so what is the, I like your point. So 2 years, like what's the worst case scenario? Well, okay, like the worst case scenario is that you have to start college at 20 and all your friends from high school are a little ahead of you, but it's like, okay, A, except for whether or not you were going to graduate in 4 years in the first place, why do you have to go to college when you're 18 versus when you're 20 versus when you're 24 versus right. in a part-time commuter program versus like a work study type equivalent? I think there's a chance for us to kind of just throw out just this, once again, like received, socially constructed, to borrow a term from the left, that's actually very helpful there, kind of pathway here. And then there, you, and given that, you don't even have to have this either or situation where you're either going into an apprenticeship or you're going to college. Because once again, it could really be that the version of you that goes to college when you're 24 is better prepared, more judicious for your time, more focused in. So I think given that, I'd love to hear what, how should we expand our conceptions thinking about this? Once again, as people who tend to have these conversations with people who went to college, who That's like right. went to these schools, swim in
That's
these
right.
circles.
And I think that, you know, your model of the, you know, the kind of 24, 25 year old, the fact of the matter is that the most students who are enrolled in college are also working. They're older. They're not your typical 18, 19 year old. They're working part-time. They're going to school part-time and they're working in jobs that are more like those kind of frontline jobs that don't have sort of career pathways built in, aren't going to lead anywhere. So I think, you know, one of the major points of apprenticeship is, you know, why not combine the learning and earning and actually, you know, have a destination at the end of it? That's the difference, right? You're sort of your average college student today is maybe working at Chipotle and, you know, taking a couple classes, so forth. Where is that going to lead? Compare that to a formal structured apprenticeship program where they're working full time and you have the learning built in. Again, they may not want to pursue that profession, but it's still a safer bet than that sort of disaggregated, you know, sort of frontline work, college, debt model that we have today. And the key is the infrastructure. We need to build it and we need to recognize who builds it. Governments don't build it. Governments can incentivize nonprofit and private enterprise to build it. And that's exactly what we've seen in the UK and Australia over the last 20, 30 years. In the UK, you have 1,200 intermediaries today who are in the business of setting up and running apprenticeship programs. They knock on employers' doors. You won't find a larger mid-sized company in the UK that hasn't been approached by a half dozen apprenticeship intermediaries offering to set up and run apprenticeship programs. So it's a thing. So it's very common. Because these intermediaries make it easier or turnkey for employers to launch apprenticeships.
And those intermediaries are funded by the government.
So in most cases, what the employer will pay for in almost every case is the apprentice wage. So mm-hmm. they're going to pay the wage, but not more than that. right? They're not paying a program fee. They're not paying for the training. They're not paying for the mentoring and coaching. That's all being done by the intermediary. That's all being done by the apprenticeship service provider. And that's funded by the government. And I would contend that that's a better investment than most of what's going into Title IV accredited colleges and universities today.
So in these last 10 minutes or so, I want to hear a response to a section of the book that I found kind of depressing. You gave these five different examples of ways that the university system is held back. And one of the points you made was just that degree programs don't change and like degree programs aren't updated. There's very little accountability of even when they add a new degree, people actually taking the degree, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You point out that, you know, Yale has a, you know, German major that obviously is not at its Cold War or pre-World War II height. Putting aside Yale, because I think German majors at Yale are going to do well no matter what they do. The most compelling response I hear from academics is just this idea that reducing this to business or reducing this purely to how do we maximize the number of business analytics degree or studiers versus our language humanities majors is kind of depressing. I think actually we would lose something there. That said, it seems to me we could find a way to teach people German or engage in the humanities or be intellectual or an academic at a price that isn't $70,000 a year with a cookie cutter approach. So what can you just think of alternate means of providing that best faith academic experience that we're trying to kind of find? Because I support that model. I just can't find it supportable at the cost that it's being charged and with the failure rate that we're seeing. 10,000 a year, 90% of people graduate. That's one thing. 70K and then only 40%. That's indefensible.
Or if everyone graduated into a $60,000 a year job, then it would be fine. We could support $45,000 of student loan debt per graduate. It would be okay. Look, I think colleges do as good a job as they've ever done at equipping young people with sort of the critical thinking skills, problem-solving skills, communication skills that they need. The problem is, as I said at the outset, those are the, you know, that's kind of penny ante today for good jobs. Mm-hmm. You need that. Employers look for more. They're looking for these digital skills and platform skills and knowledge and experience and so forth. So that's the fundamental challenge. I don't think that that's necessarily damning of the liberal arts and humanities at all. In fact, you know, let's forget about German. Let's look at, you know, business majors. How many employers do you know are hiring out of college someone who's just been a business major and doesn't have, that's not, you know, what business, but what you're learning in that, you know, program of study is probably not going to be particularly relevant for, you know, what an employer is going to want you to do in an entry-level position in any company in any industry, really, not useful. I would, as an employer, I would much rather hire someone who's been a humanities or philosophy a student who's all combined that with relevant skill building and work experience that relates to the job that I need them to do. And so it's not really a question of program of study. It's a question of making sure that we're integrating that skill building and work experience into the degree program. I just, you know, had a meeting with someone who said, college should be 2 years or 3 years, and the last year should be, you know, a paid internship. And that would be an improvement for sure on what we have now. The co-op model that Northeastern and Drexel have is an improvement on what we have now. Of course, and this is sort of interesting, as a, speaking of sort of the monolithic, non-diverse model that we have, everyone sort of winnowing to a single Harvard-like model, Northeastern, which got famous and successful and now increasingly selective on the back of its co-op program, I heard through the grapevine, no longer intends to feature co-op and work experience in its marketing because it's kind of gotten too big for that. It's too selective for that now. So that's almost a negative for Northeastern at this point. It's like risen to the top echelon.
That's the kind of the rankings reduce everyone to following this model point you made.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I don't think it's that. I think what it calls for is creativity. I think it calls for mandates at the administration, board, and accreditor level to ensure that graduates are getting these skills and work experience as well. And it's going to require faculty to do a lot more than just pull out the old, the lecture notes out of the shoebox that they've been teaching for 20 years and just keep, doing the same thing over and over again. They can't keep doing the same thing. It's not working. Some of what they're doing is great, but they need to supplement that with skill building and experience, work experience. And that's going to require them to do things differently and the institutions to do things differently too. Because setting up a formalized co-op or internship program, let alone apprenticeship program, is not in the DNA of any college or university.
So here's the last question, especially post-dot-com bubble. A lot of the model that higher ed reformers have kind of utilized is this idea that there's this higher education bubble, and eventually that bubble is going to pop. And a lot of these socially constructed realities we just discussed are just going to go away. It's just not sustainable, like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems that now that we've ran through the 2008 financial crisis, now that COVID happened and universities were able to like increase their prices while literally delivering by their own standards worse service, I just don't think reformers can wait for a bubble to pop. The legacy offering just has too much narrative strength, even with declining enrollment, those different features. This is a longer run thing from my perspective. That said, if you buy my frame that we've just gone on too long without a bubble popping to expect that to be the solution, what should happen over the next few years that in the next decade or so could put us in the right place? Like, what are the immediate next steps you'd like to
see? Look, I think the big problem is that there's a lot of energy around finding alternatives. But no clear alternative has arisen. And so as a result, every time,
everyone throws out the new alternative.
Exactly. Boot camps. Every time this becomes an issue, states and the federal government just keep throwing more money at what they know, which is college. And what I'm saying is,
because the alternative flavor of the month can't meet whatever the challenge is. So everyone just regresses back to like, okay, it was just like fun college.
Correct. And I think that, this paradigm of we have tuition-based, we have earn and learn. We've overinvested in tuition. We've underinvested in earn and learn. Let's build that earn and learn infrastructure. And as we do, we're going to see it flower and we're going to see all kinds of behavioral changes as a result, because for most young people, that is going to be a surer bet, a higher return on investment than what our current, college tuition-based system offers.
That is an excellent place to leave the conversation. Ryan, Craig, this has been really great. I'm going to do a lot of coverage of this topic over the coming years, so this is a great foundation to set. Thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Marshall, thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.